Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to the 49ers Insider Podcast on NBC Sports Bay Area.com. Introducing your host, San Francisco 49ers Insider, Matt Mayoko.
You ready to make podcast history here?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. Should we count it down?
Or do they? Yeah, if you want.
Okay. 3, 2, 1.
Oh, come on.
3, 2, 1. Hey, Mindy, how you doing? Should we start over?
Yeah. You got to do your 3, 2, 1.
Oh, come on.
You
right.
Always
that's
do it to me. Yeah. Always when we're about ready to go on camera.
3, 2, 1. It's another edition of the 49ers Insider Podcast. Mindy.
Hey. Hi.
Do you know who is going to be on the podcast later?
I don't.
Carmen Policy.
Oh. Sorry, can we start all over? I know we're hot. Can we just start all over? I'm just like, screw this. I knew Carmen was going to be on it, but I thought you were going to throw it to somebody else.
I'm no.
Like, well, yeah.
Yeah, so Carmen Policy is going to be on the 49ers. We need to introduce ourselves. Okay. I'm Matt Mayoko.
And I'm Mindy Bogg. So nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
I'm a little silly
we
today.
Did this a couple of weeks ago with Matt Barkley before the podcast with him, and now we're doing it. So Carmen Policy will be joining me on the podcast. I haven't
That's
talked
great.
To him yet, but you don't want to know. Do you want to know what the hook is?
Absolutely.
So
I
the
hope
hook
it has to do with his wine.
I don't know how much we'll be talking about the wine, but here's the hook. David Coppett, a very smart guy, had this idea of, you know, with the Warriors and the Cavaliers playing for the NBA Finals 3 years in a row, that's a very rare thing in mm-hmm. sports. Baseball, it happened in the 20s with the Giants and the Yankees. In the NFL, it happened in the early 50s with the Lions and the Browns. In the NHL, it happened in the mid-50s with Montreal and Detroit. But David Coppett says, well, you know what? Even though it wasn't the Super Bowl, when the 49ers and the Cowboys played
right.
each other from, what was it, 92, 93, 94, after mm-hmm. those seasons, it was basically for the championship.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the correlation. And so I'm going to be talking to Carmen about the arms race, 49ers and Cowboys. Cowboys won those first two championship games, went on to win the Super Bowl. The 49ers went all in mm-hmm. in 94, got Deion Sanders. They beat the Cowboys at Candlestick Park, and then they won the Super Bowl.
Well, and I remember so clearly talking to Carmen about this, and it was specifically that second game where they lost to the Cowboys. He said he and Eddie DeBartola were in the elevator and were fuming.
Yeah.
We're just looking at each other and said, not again. This will not happen to us again. So right after that game, they set the wheels in motion for the 94 season, which led to the Super Bowl, the 49ers' last Super Bowl that they won. And that's why they went out, exactly, you're exactly right, and got Deion Sanders and just made sure that that team was going to do the absolute best to beat the Cowboys. And That was the impetus right there, that
yeah.
elevator ride after that loss.
Deion Sanders, Kevin Durant.
Exactly.
Mentioned them in the same sentence.
Yeah, absolutely. I could see that. I see the
Carmen Policy, Bob Myers.
Mm-hmm. But yeah. Hopefully Kevin Durant will stay around a lot longer than one season.
I would think so.
Team.
Yeah.
So,
Deion was in for 1 year, made his mark, NFL Defensive Player of the Year. And then he
yeah.
moved on.
Absolutely.
So we'll talk with Carmen about the 49ers of yesteryear and the 49ers of today.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking forward to that. Always fun to talk to Carmen Policy.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see his take on where this team is now. and how it's looking to rebuild. Because everyone points to, obviously, the first year that Bill Walsh came in. Obviously, he took over a team that was horrible, and they went 2-14 his first year before it really turned around. I just think you can't make those comparisons. You have to move forward, move ahead. The league is different. The personnel are different. The systems are different. Strategies and Kyle Shanahan, what he brings is going to be his own stamp. So I understand it, but obviously it's way too soon. But it will be interesting to see what commonalities, though, those intangibles you hear about in sports all the time, that you need an upper management and coaching to just bring those aspects on the field to the forefront to make a winning team.
Yeah, I would think
if he sees the base of that, if he sees the start of that.
I would think Carmen would have some thoughts about Kyle Shanahan.
Exactly.
Mike Shanahan was on the staff as the offensive coordinator for that Super Bowl, when the 49ers finally got over the mountain and beat Dallas in 94, January of 95. And then went on to what was their fifth Super Bowl, fifth, and right now they're still on number five. But it's amazing what a change in coaching can do. And I know it seems like every year that we talk about the coaching change, there's always the optimism at first.
Absolutely.
And with Jim Tomsula, it was probably contrived a little bit. People kind of hoping more than really believing that he was going to be a good fit as head coach. I think same last year with Chip Kelly. But with Kyle Shanahan, we see already just how detailed he is. He's an offensive-minded head coach. His offense it has a proven track record in the NFL with success, and man, watching these practices, he is so detailed, and you see it. In fact, I talked with Marquise Goodwin, one of the 49ers' new wide receivers. He's the track guy, the guy who qualified for the 2012 Olympics in the long jump. No one's ever questioned his physical ability, but he really sees this offense as a perfect fit for him because of just how detailed it is.
Yeah, and what did he tell you about that detail, though?
Well, the detail is that he told me that he was kind of sickened. That's the word he used, sickened, when he hears people say that he's only fast, he can't run routes, he can't catch. And he told me that the reason people think that is because he's never been in a detailed offense when he was with the Buffalo Bills, never a real detailed offense. They would only have him run the go route and the comeback. And so he's really looking forward to lining up in different spots and running all kinds of different routes. In fact, here's what he had to say about the detail and how much he likes Kyle Shanahan's offense. And he relates it to his track expertise and how detailed he is in the long jump.
You can't see my arms, but I got goosebumps. Yeah, because I think being detail oriented is what separates you. And the proof is in the pudding. They had one of the most prolific offenses last year in Atlanta because they paid attention to detail. When you put on the tape, you watch the tape, you can see that all the guys are honed in on detail, and it becomes like second nature, kind of like tying your shoes. You're walking down the hallway, shoes untied, you're going to reach over, you're going to bend down and tie them. The same with if I got a certain assignment on this play, I do it without thinking because it's what I'm supposed to do. And that's what he's trying to ingrain in us right now. So we've done things one way for so long, been on different teams, and we all come together and try to accept our role in this offense or this team. And just being detail-oriented, I think, and really, really keying in on those details every day, I think that's what the difference maker is. It's the same with track and field. Mm-hmm. Nobody goes out there half-stepping. Everything has to be to a T. Like, I have one mark for track, my long jump, and I'm expected to hit the board whether the wind is behind my back or the wind is in front of me. I still got to hit that same mark at the same time in the same amount of steps. Imagine how detailed you got to be in that. you know. So imagine how focused in on the little things you got to be. So that's why when it comes to football and a coach like this, that's right up my alley, because I practice that even when I'm outside of football.
I think what's interesting, though, about what Kyle Shanahan is doing with his team, which is different than when Chip Kelly was with this team and Jim Tomsula the year before that, was that Kyle Shanahan is building his own roster. He has had so much change, and he knows what he wants, where Chip Kelly and Jim Tomsula were dealing with a roster in hand and didn't make very many changes at all. You remember when Tomsula came in and there were no free agents added, where they certainly could have used some. And I spoke to Joe Staley recently, and he said there definitely is an energy out there, but it also has everybody on edge, so Kyle Shanahan is getting the best out of all those players, because Joe was saying, you know, he'll bring guys in and they'll work out with the team for a while, and if he doesn't see from them what he needs or how he thinks he could fit for whatever reason, he's like, they're gone. So everyone's on notice. You know, I'll bring you in, I'll give you the shot, but if I don't see it, Joe was saying there's no qualms about letting those players go. I mean, they have the salary cap room. They have so many spots open to competition this year. It was just interesting to hear that from a player, too, that even the veterans, like Joe was laughing. He's like, yeah, there was a lot of turnover at the end of Chip Kelly's season. He's like, and this year there's so many new guys. And I go up and I introduce myself. Hey, I'm Joe Staley. And he's like, so many are like, dude, yeah, I know. I was here last year. Joe's like, I can't keep track. And Torrey Smith, when he was here, the last game of the season last year that they won, right?
Yeah.
And he said, I was like, congratulations, Joe. Congratulations. This dude who just came to the team. And I remember just seeing that interview with Torrey, their last game of the season. They didn't know half the guys on the team. So it's a complete rebuild. I mean, from the bottom up, even with the veterans that are here. The fact that they're able to stay says a lot about them as well.
I think that some of this in putting together this roster, I think last year you had, or the past how many ever years, you've had a very rigid general manager.
Absolutely.
And I don't think, I know the general manager and the head coach, and you name the head coach, whoever it was, Harbaugh, Tomsula, Chip Kelly, I don't think they worked well together. And I think with John Lynch, you have a general manager who's really willing to work with the head coach and give the head coach what the head coach wants. You know, I think he probably went from certainly the most powerful person in the building being Trent Baalke, certainly the last 2 years, to now, and probably the last year with Harbaugh as well, to now a head coach, Kyle Shanahan, who doesn't need the power, but works more hand-in-hand with John Lynch. And I think John Lynch wants Kyle Shanahan to like tell him what do you need, what does your coaching staff need, and then let's go get him.
And if there's anything, back to the NBA final, Kyle Shanahan went to the first game of the NBA final between Cleveland and the Warriors. And I think right there is management, head coaching relationship between Steve Kerr and Bob Myers that everyone in every league is, you know, trying to emulate. Look what the Warriors did in 3 years. You know, they had talent. They brought in more talent. They brought in Steve Kerr. He was able to implement his system. He had the support of the team. You know, he was able to implement it. And people are taking notice, you know, across all leagues. And I think that's a big example for John Lynch, a first-time general manager, even a different league, to go over there and see that. How does this work? How do these relationships work? And how do you get the best out of your players?
I think there's a lot to be gleaned from sport to sport, don't you?
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. And I think that's the big thing that was missing, I believe, last year under Chip Kelly and even the year under Tomsula, was that the players, if they weren't at their best, there was no depth there. There was no one to push them. Who could you bench them for and put in their stead? No one. So you could coach and you could try to get the best out of your player, but there wasn't the responsibility on behalf of the players. And they even said so after Chip Kelly was let go. And so it'll be interesting to see how those players who remain, you know, are able to get that back. Obviously, there's some players that didn't have those issues, but there wasn't the competition there. If somebody had a bad game, it was, oh, well, because who else are you going to put in if you bench that player? There wasn't that. It seems like this year the competition is going to be more fierce and bring out the best in players.
Boy, that's a good lead into another guy I talked to this week.
Yeah.
Quentin Dial. Mm-hmm. You know, the 49ers have drafted defensive linemen with their first pick each of the past three seasons. And Quentin Dial is kind of the forgotten man. You know, he's now moved to nose tackle, where they have Earl Mitchell right now, the veteran who they brought in, has been in the system before. They have him running with the first team. But Quentin Dial is very excited about being in this new system. And the guys that they drafted, Eric Armstead, DeForest Buckner, Solomon Thomas, there's really not much overlap there with Dial because he's going to be a nose tackle. So he talked about, you know, seeing those three guys come in, and also what you just mentioned, the accountability that was lacking last year and why the 49ers defense, their run defense in particular, was so bad. So here's Quentin Dial.
My opinion personally about it, I think it's we're trying to gear back to what the defense have done in the past when they won all the Super Bowls in the past, is make this a defensive organization. And, you know, that's my opinion about it, and I like it because, I mean, that's what I want to be known for, is having a great defense. And, you know, you're going to have guys that you're going to get every year. But I think we're trying to get back there. It's just going to be one step at a time, brick by brick.
Last year, I mean, there's no reason why you guys should have been the worst run defense in the league.
Yeah.
So why were you?
I think when you take into consideration guys not being accountable to themselves and to the teammates, number one, first and foremost. And I think when the coaching staff don't hold you to a higher standard than you should be upheld to, you know, I don't think that's a good correlation. I mean, you're set up for failure.
And he was a player, Quentin, who really started coming into his own. And I was excited to see that development. I think that's one of the great things about covering a team and players from their rookie years, when you see their growth. You know, there's always potential when you start, but then when you start seeing it to be fulfilled, that's exciting for me. I do enjoy that. And Quentin came in, and not a lot of expectations his rookie year, not a lot of opportunity his rookie year, but then his second year really started to improve. But then it didn't seem to take off. You know, I would like to see if he can get back on track this season under Kyle Shanahan as a nose tackle. What else did he tell you about that?
Yeah, I mean, he talked about wanting to be a three-down player, you know, that he's working on his pass rush. He thinks that he can be a good pass rusher. They're changing schemes, so he's going to be a one gap. You know, he's only going to be responsible for one gap, whereas in the past he was head up, you know, and playing two gaps. He thinks that he can become a three-down player and add something from a pass rush standpoint. His defensive line coach is Jeff Scanina. He played in the NFL for like 17 years and played in this system. And so he's learning a lot from him. And it kind of sounds like, you know, he feels like a guy who's been there before, a guy who's played in the league before, knows what it takes, can tell if a guy is working hard or not, or cutting corners. He seems to think that Jeff Scanina is going to be really good for this young 49ers defensive line. A defensive line, when you think about it, really didn't have any leaders last year.
No.
You know, with Justin Smith gone, actually the past 2 years, right? With Justin Smith gone, who's the guy who walks into that defensive line room, you know, carrying the big stick and like whips these guys into shape and shows them how to be professionals? I think the leadership from this line group is going to come from the defensive line coach. I'm going to put you on the spot. Anything you'd like me to ask Carmen Policy while I have him on the line?
Congratulate him, obviously, on being inducted into the Bay Area Sports Hall of Fame this year. And I don't know. I think the question for him would be, what management coach relationship, back to what we're talking about, for across all professional sports, does he think right now is the strongest that needs to be emulated? Is it the Warriors? Is it what we see at the Patriots? Is it in another league? You know, what does he think I'm curious on his take on the best management coaching partnerships in professional sports. That's a question I would ask
Carmen. That's a good question. I will definitely ask him that. So Carmen Policy coming up now on the 49ers Insider Podcast. And Mindy, this has been fun to sit down and just chat.
I'm more excited for training camp this year than I've been in a while. So it's fun to talk a little football with you because I'm covering a lot of baseball right now. So you can keep me grounded.
Well, Carmen, thank you so much for joining me on the 49ers Insider Podcast.
Well, this is my pleasure. First of all, it's always a pleasure talking to you. And it's also kind of neat to be asked to talk about the good old days when I haven't initiated the conversation. This is fun.
Yeah, well, I know a lot of people do like to talk about the good old days. And in kind of the what we're talking about today, or what kind of brings this on, is the Cavaliers and the Warriors and the great rivalry they have, and three straight championship matchups. And one of my bosses said, hey, what about when the 49ers and the Cowboys played? You know, it's been 50 years since anything like this has happened in major, you know, in the major sports. But the thought was, you know, when the 49ers and the Cowboys were battling on a yearly basis in the early 1990s, even though it wasn't for the Super Bowl, it was for the NFC Championship, which basically was the Super Bowl.
And I must say, and this is something we would never say at the time, but as you look back, and I think we kind of recognized it even when everything was occurring, it was the winner of the NFC Championship game in 92, 93, 94 that everyone knew would be the winner of the Super Bowl. And so we truly did view, I think Dallas likewise viewed, the NFC Championship game as the real Super Bowl test. And it turned out that way, of course. It just was such a big game, each and every one of them. And you could almost feel the pain or the glory from all of the critical plays. It was pretty special.
Well, one of the great things about the 49ers of those days was you guys just didn't talk it. You lived it. And, you know, by the saying that anything short of a championship was a failure. So let me take you back to 92. You know, you guys had a exceptional team. Cowboys were kind of upstarts in a sense, and they came to Candlestick in the NFC Championship game and won that. What did that do to the organization?
Well, it rocked us, to be very honest with you. And now what I'm going to say, I would never say if I were still in the business. But I still contend that there was a phantom holding call that changed the course of that game when that flag came out against us. I'm not necessarily saying we'd have definitely won, but I am going to say that I think without that holding call at that point in time on our offense, it just was so wrong. And I think that the whole momentum of the game could have changed. But it also started us looking in the mirror and saying, wow, we're dealing with a real juggernaut here in Dallas. And
an emerging juggernaut, right?
An emerging juggernaut. And they're young and they're cocky, and we had better get with it. And what are we going to do? And then, of course, that was further accentuated the following year, when we go down to Dallas and we have to lose that game, which we shouldn't have lost. And it was after the second game, the 1993 season, when Eddie and I were getting on the elevator at Dallas Stadium and going down into the locker room. And he wasn't out of line. He wasn't emotional. He was intent. And he looked at me and he said, "We cannot allow this to happen again. We won't allow it to happen again." That's it. Didn't yell, didn't scream. But he could have set off fireworks prior to and after, and it wouldn't have had more of an effect on me. And that's when we made up our minds, we're going to find the missing pieces, and we're going to get it done in 1994.
Well, I mean, your perspective, you were in it. Me not being in it, I saw that 92 team with the 49ers. I thought you guys were better than Dallas, and as you mentioned, that was a game you probably should have won, could have won, definitely. The next year, I thought there was no question Dallas was better than you guys. Did you sense that, and do you think that that's kind of what sparked it? Like, okay, this time it wasn't a fluke. Dallas was the better team. We have to do something to now recapture that.
I agree with you in both points you made. We did think we were the better team in 92. In 93, we had to honestly say to ourselves, we can win this game, but they're a better team. And, you know, when Troy Aikman got hurt in the 93 season game, which, of course, was played in January 94, we had a shot to really take that game away from them. And the backup quarterback, Bernie Kosar, comes in, and instead of getting sacked, he winds up with this one play that moved them out of out of harm's way. Again, the whole thing went sideways on us. And that's, as you put it, and that's when we said, uh-oh, this wasn't a fluke. This is something that we've now gone backwards instead of forward. And a sense of desperation, in effect, set in. And then don't forget, we not only were facing an increasingly dominant Dallas competitor, we were also facing the prospects of a salary cap that came into existence.
Came into existence because of you guys, right?
Well, basically, the NFL, with their think tank full of lawyers and accountants, said, okay, let's create a salary cap structure that will dismantle the 49ers. And they also put in there the Washington Redskins, but we were the first and foremost model that they used. How do we dismantle the 49ers and not allow them to get around it? And, I mean, it was out of respect to us. Don't misunderstand. I'm not saying that they were totally criticizing us and so forth, but they designed the cap around a team like ours that was spending the way we were spending and developing the talent, the depth of talent that we had. Dallas didn't have that problem at that time. So many of their players were young players. They came in through the draft. They had that great trade with Minnesota that Jimmy Johnson orchestrated, and they were able to bring these young players in playing on those some of them rookie contracts. And so their cap was well in place. Jerry was willing to spend cash as needed. They almost had no constraints whatsoever. And we were pulling players off the practice field to redo contracts to try to make additional room within our cap structure so that we would be able to bring in the special pieces, and the special pieces being free agents that really, truly added a whole different dimension to our defense especially, and to our offense as well.
And so some of those guys, you took Ken Norton Jr. away from Dallas, which always helps to take a piece away from the team that you're trying to overcome. And you brought in Gary Plummer, two guys who were in the middle of that defense and played very well. But the big addition came later with Deion Sanders. And
Deion Sanders was key.
Yeah.
But let's not forget somebody else. We brought in, the linebacker from New Orleans. Ricky Jackson. And Ricky Jackson was a major factor, too. Sometimes I'm not sure we remember some of the contributions he made. And by the way, in order to bring Ricky Jackson in, his contract had to be what we call backloaded. And backloaded means it was a lot of incentives. And the types of incentives he had were not counted toward the cap in that year because they were achievements the team hadn't met in either 92 or 93. So they would be categorized by the league as incentives that were not likely to be earned. So they wouldn't be included unless he earned them, and then they'd be included in the cap in the following year. He earned every one of those incentives. And by the way, so did Deion. And they were just marvelous. And then we can't forget something else. We had a very good draft that year, too. That's when we got Brian Young, William Floyd.
Lee Woodall.
Lee Woodall, right, Lee Woodall. And we were doing pretty darn well. But to show you how we were backed up against the wall with the cap, if we don't trade our linebacker to Philadelphia, Bill Romanowski, if we don't trade him on the morning of the draft, we don't have enough cap space to draft. So we either had to trade him or cut him. And we were able to pull off a trade, thank God, and the trade got done. It was a favorable trade for us. It worked out very well for Philadelphia, too. I mean, don't misunderstand, it was a two-way street. And then we were able to have all the cap room we needed to have a complete draft. So that's what we faced. And thank God it all came together, and some of the players had enough faith in us to go along with the suggestions we made and the kind of contracts we proposed. We were able to field a team that ultimately, some say, could have been the best team we ever fielded.
Yeah, and the final piece, as I mentioned, was Deion Sanders. And, you know, for a coach who, he didn't necessarily encourage characters on the team or people stepping outside and creating an individual identity, how much discussion was there of the pros and cons of adding Deion Sanders, a tremendous player, but somebody who might not have been seen as somebody who would fit into that team structure of what you guys had built?
Well, let me put it to you this way. Anybody who knows my extremely close and very good friend George Seifert will tell you that George is a pretty straightforward guy. And he believes in a traditional kind of approach to life, to hunting, to fishing, and to football. And bringing Deion Sanders in was not an easy thing. And do you have time for a quick story?
Absolutely.
So Ray Rhodes was our defensive coordinator. And do you remember Ray?
Yes, Ray Bob.
And he was a great, Ray Bob was a great defensive coach. And so Eddie DeBartolo, Ray, Coach Rhodes, myself, were at the Marriott Hotel out there by the airport, which was our team hotel. That's where we stayed with the team on Saturdays before a Sunday game or on Sunday before a Monday night game. And we're there and Deion's there. So now we're going to have Deion be driven down to meet with George Seifert at Santa Clara to talk about him becoming a member of the 49ers. We had worked out all the details. Now the last detail was, can he fit with George and can George fit with him? And he was going to cover everything. He's going to cover, he wants to play offense, he wants to return punts, he wants to return kickoffs, he wants to do this, he wants to do that. And George's attitude was, we are the 49ers. We have a 49er way of doing things. We have top pros on our team, and it would be disrespectful to ignore them, their positions on the teams, and all that they've earned and so forth. So this was not exactly viewed as a slam dunk. But Ray was, he was almost on his knees praying because he wanted Deion so bad he could taste it. So we're sitting there and we're waiting. So finally, Eddie looks at Ray, says, you feel like a drink? And Ray says, Mr. D, I need one. So we started having, you know, some wine and whatever. Well, I'd say some real time went by, and all of a sudden, Deion comes in with a look on his face. Ray Bob ordered a double. ordered a double. And he says, quick, get me a double real quick. I think I'm going to need it. And when Dion sat down, Eddie said, how'd it go, Dion? How did it all go with the coach? And Dion says, well, let's put it this way. It wasn't a recruiting trip. and he told us about, you know, it was a tough, tough conversation. However, by and large, we ultimately got it done. And the deal was, let's see how you fit in. Let's see how it gets together. You're here for one reason, Dion. You want to win a championship. We want you here for a reason. We want to win a championship. Let's work toward that, and then we'll see how flexible we can get down the road. And he signed, and we moved forward. And it was a special.
Yeah, Super Bowl championship. You guys beat the Cowboys 38-28 in the NFC Championship game. You're named NFL Executive of the Year. I mean, that was a very special time. And the last, you know, the last Super Bowl that the 49ers have won. It's been a while.
Yep. And you know, Eddie and I would talk about this. And obviously, for all the reasons that anyone could imagine, we wanted to win Super Bowls and championships. And we really, truly did think the fans deserved it. And we honestly did feel that that's our goal. That anything short of that is, we're not saying it was a terrible season, but it wasn't a success. And we had players like Steve Young, Jerry Rice, Tim McDonald came on board with us, and Harris Barton was part of our group, and Brent Jones, and you can't sell these guys out. When they're used to being part of a championship environment, you had to give it everything you possibly could to give them another shot at another ring and another trophy. You owed it to them as well as to the fans, as well as to the concept of the 49ers. And that's why we felt this sacred mission, if you will, to do the best we possibly could to put the best possible team on the field, to get that one last shot at least. And it came to fruition, and it was the most satisfying situation, I can tell you, that I've had in my lifetime. And I would say that next to being inducted into the Hall of Fame, it might have been the most satisfying period for Eddie. I'm not saying it was the most exhilarating, because you start going back in the 80s and that first Super Bowl and so forth, and we're kids. We were kids. And, you know, there was some real big-time excitement connected with the 80s. But the 90s were like the fulfillment of the Empire's dynasty and destiny. So it kind of brought things home and closed the circle.
I see a lot of parallels between the 49ers of then and the Warriors of now. And, you know, the Warriors would have entered this season as the favorites to win the NBA championship. But yet Bob Myers went out and didn't just settle for being the favorite. He went out and got the Deion Sanders. He got Kevin Durant. Have you thought about that, about how the Warriors approach now kind of mirrors what the 49ers were doing when you were running the show as team president?
I thought about it often. And I commended the Warriors and gave them a standing ovation here in my home for doing what they did, with the proviso that Kevin Durant has to fit. I also commended that team because no matter how good Kevin Durant's intentions, he's not going to fit if the other stars on the team don't let him. These guys were part of the recruiting process. These guys were part of the welcoming committee. They were able to look him in the eye and deal with him and follow through on their commitments and say, in effect, this is about team. This is about the Warriors. This isn't about Steph Curry. This isn't about Draymond Green. This isn't about Klay Thompson. This is about the Warriors winning a championship. You can help us we will help you. When you get that kind of unselfishness and the ability of a team to think in terms of working together as a unit and everybody sharing the glory, no one caring about how much of it attached to them personally, when everybody's willing to share all the glory that comes with a victory, there's no stopping what you can do. It's just, it's a beautiful thing to behold. And what you're seeing over there in Oakland right now with the Warriors is something that's precious. It's precious in sport and it's precious in life. And it's a lesson for all of us. And it's a lesson I wish we could expand and export more clearly, because there's so much to be learned by what happened here. And you have to look at ownership, and you've got to look at their commitment and what a difference they made from the time they took over and their commitment to winning. I mean, Eddie DeBartolo always had a commitment to winning. When he wound up owning the 49ers, he developed a whole new sense of currency. Yes, there was the normal financial considerations that go with running any organization, especially a big-time sports organization like an NFL franchise. But his currency really was victories. That's how he would measure the net value of his franchise, not by the balance sheet. And with that kind of an attitude, it goes throughout the entire organization, and you all of a sudden start developing a singular goal. And that singular goal becomes like this great light on the hill. You don't lose your way. You know exactly where you have to go to get to the promised land. And I sense that's where they are over at the Warriors headquarters. And I like the people. Don't you like the people that are playing for them? Even the characters, even the ones who are, you know, on the edge, you kind of after a while start saying, you know, that's him. And they embrace him.
Well, they're a team, right? I mean, they're just a
team. They're a team. Exactly.
And they're a team from top to bottom. I mean, the management structure and how the management is working with the head coach, and, you know, it just seems like everybody is lockstep on the same page and pulling in the same direction.
And everybody's a quality human being. Rick Welts, I mean, you look at him and you start saying, wow, I root for this guy. And look at the coach. I mean, we're over here. I mean, my wife prays for him at church, you know, hoping he gets better and hoping he can return. And then this, I don't even know if you call him assistant coach, Brown, but when he steps in there, it's almost like they didn't lose a step. They didn't miss a heartbeat. And it's all part of that culture and that ethos that's been created over there that flows from top, as you put it, all the way from top to bottom. And everybody's infected with it, and everybody's bought into it. So it's pretty cool to watch, and it's pretty cool to be part of it.
Yeah, my colleague Mindy Bach, I was talking to her as we lead into this interview. We talked just a little while ago. First thing she said to me is, make sure you congratulate Carmen on his election into the Bay Area Sports Hall of Fame. So, Carmen, on behalf of Mindy and myself, congratulations. You joined a terrific class in January that includes Kerry Walsh Jennings, Matt Williams, Bill Cartwright, and Russell Bays. So, congratulations.
Thank you very much, Matt. I must be frank with you. It meant a lot to me. And it was it had an even bigger effect on me than I thought it would. And the evening of the induction was kind of magical. The guys were there, and they were funny and animated, and Eddie DeBartolo gave the speech of his life. He really worked on it, and he brought the house down laughing on at least a dozen or more occasions during his speech, and it was a very, very uplifting and a pretty heady experience for me and my family.
Mindy also, she had a question for you. She wanted your take, and we've talked about the Warriors, but what do you consider kind of the gold standard now in professional sports that has kind of mastered that management-coach relationship, and what teams in any sport now should be trying to emulate, just as teams tried to emulate you guys throughout the 80s and 90s.
Well, I'm going to stay with our conversation. I'm going to point you right to the Golden State Warriors. I think they're the new gold standard in terms of organization, style of management, coaching, embracing the players as a family, and yet understanding that every member of the family is different, and you're going to have the really good kids that you don't even have to oversee them doing their homework, and they're going to bring home straight A's. And then you're going to have the dreamers that are out there kind of figuring, well, why did the stars flash across at night? And, oh, I forgot to read my book. Oh, I actually forgot to bring my homework home and stuff like that.
Did the dog eat the homework?
with some of the guys we used to have, we worried about the guys eating the dog. But the thing is, I think they're the ones you point to, you know. And I have to tell you, I felt that way also in many ways about the Giants. I mean, we really enjoyed rooting for the Giants. Now, I don't mean to suggest that you only enjoy it when they win a championship. But winning the championship really brings the point home, because that's the ultimate goal. That's the ultimate prize. And when they operated the way they did, with the quality of management and the quality of coaching and the quality of their players, and you love their players, you root for their players, you know what happens? You like and respect them. And, oh, by the way, these guys are winning championships too. How could it get better than that? So now they're, you know, having some hard times on the field, but they're a great organization too. But right now, I think that the Warriors are at the crest of all of these, all of the sport franchises, and they're the ones to look to. And then don't discount their achievements off the field in the area of finance and in the area of team advancement. That location at Mission Bay for the new arena, even though it's going to present some problems for us, I'm on the board at UCSF, and we're a little concerned down there with what's going to happen traffic-wise and otherwise. But the truth of the matter is, it's going to be a world-class, state-of-the-art facility, and it will really, truly, in my opinion, elevate not only the financial value of that franchise, but the standing of the franchise. And I hope the fans could afford it, but I think the fan experiences there will be just unbelievable.
For someone like yourself, who I'm sure really looks at that management to coach relationship, and me covering this, the 49ers organization for more than 20 years, I've seen it a lot of different instances of where it works and where it doesn't work. Well, it hasn't worked very well and I'm putting it mildly here in the last few years. But now that you see what they've done as far as the pairing of Kyle Shanahan and John Lynch, and certainly they haven't played any games yet, so there hasn't been a great deal of stress on that relationship. But what do you think about that matching of Shanahan and Lynch?
I think for a change, there's some optimism about what's happening with the Niners' structure in terms of the front office. Because even when they were winning with Harbaugh, you knew there was no harmony in that front office, and you knew there was going to be conflict, and you sensed that, you know, okay, here we are at the family reunion dinner, and all right, everybody came and everybody's sitting down, but you're just so nervous because you know at any minute somebody's going to say something and a food fight will start, you know? Whereas now, I think you've got Kyle Shanahan, who is totally committed to X's and O's and coaching the team and doesn't want to be the visible and verbal face of the franchise. He wants to coach football. He wants to become a championship caliber coach with a championship caliber team. And then you have John Lynch, who's a hardworking guy, who's one of these people that, okay, give me a goal. Once I have the goal, I'll figure out how to get around all the obstacles. Everything he's done in life says that he can not only be successful, but he's going to be driven to be the best. And his reputation at Fox as a as an announcer and as an on-air talent was just spectacular. And they braved about him as a member of the team and as the way he worked, how he approached the job, how he was willing to go way beyond anything expected of him just to make himself and to make the situation better. And you've got harmony. I just have the feeling that with that harmony and with this situation causing the front office to get its feet on the ground and settle down and let's start building, you've got a shot of this thing turning around. Now, don't expect it to turn around this year. I think we all know that. And I think that they have to really, really settle the quarterback situation, because quarterbacks are key. If you don't have a quarterback, you don't have anything. You know, that was the old line way of thinking. Now, maybe that's not quite so true in today's day and age with dominant defenses and so forth, but the truth of the matter is, especially when you're the San Francisco 49ers, get yourself a quarterback. So that's got to get resolved.
Carmen, have you had any contact with John Lynch or the 49ers organization in this offseason?
No, I haven't had any contact. I mean, I've only reached out to John and Kyle to congratulate them, and their responses to me were likewise very, very nice. And of course, I'm still very, you know, Mike Shanahan's always been a friend, so I'm a friend of Mike Shanahan's. We were supposed to have dinner, but we just couldn't put our two schedules together, and then I couldn't get down to the South Bay, and he couldn't get up to the Napa Valley. So we the dates in the city just didn't work. So we're going to try to get together maybe this month. But no, I really don't have any connection with the organization, and I'm just a fan now. I'm kind of sitting here and observing.
Kyle Shanahan was a ball boy with the 49ers. Do you remember him running around the practice fields?
I do. I remember him running around. He used to go to training camp with his dad, and he'd even be around the office. But then I remember he played ball in high school, you know, but he was a kid. And it was so much fun as he started playing ball. And then I used to tease Mike. I said, Mike, what kind of father are you to let your kid go into coaching? You know, it's just, I said, well, you should be charged with dereliction of parental duty. And he would laugh and he said, yeah, I tried talking to him. And then my wife tried talking to him, but he says, you know, that's his passion. That's what he wants to do. So how am I going to dissuade him from it? And then look at what happened. I mean, here he is. The head coach of the 49ers, and that's just incredible. And he was probably a couple of plays away from winning the Super Bowl. So he's come a long way. And I think having a John Lynch on board with Kyle will give Kyle the time and the opportunity he needs to develop into a head coach. He cannot be – I think it would be such a disservice to him and to the organization if he had to worry about – how the front office gets handled, worry about the cap, worry about who's going to be signing him and who's going to do the contract negotiations, and worrying about coming out and reaching out to the public and the media and explaining who they are and what they are and what they're doing. This is going to really create an environment for Kyle where he has a chance to really develop into a coach.
Yeah, and the 49ers this offseason, you know, they've done a lot of things, including hiring John Lynch, a general manager who is kind of a face of the franchise guy who puts the organization in a positive light. Recently, the 49ers have also announced that mostly because of fan response, they're doing a lot more to honor the past at Levi's Stadium, including a ring of honor with retired numbers and inductees into the Edward J. DeBarlow Sr. 49ers Hall of Fame, recognition of the five Super Bowls. I know you would think that would have happened from the outset, but I mean, are those encouraging signs for you that maybe the organization is starting to kind of get it and give the fans what they want about what it means to step into that arena and be watching not only the 49ers out there in uniform at that particular time, but also what those people represent.
I do think that it's very encouraging that they seem to be willing to go the extra step and do some things that, in my humble opinion, are very smart and very appropriate, such as honoring the past, because the past is not a simple past. The past is not just memories of things that have occurred, events that have happened. This past, the past that belongs to the 49ers, was Camelot. It was the stuff the fairy tales are made of. And by remembering it and highlighting it, what you're doing is you're recreating for your fan base reasons for the love affair. And you're also recreating for them those good years, the good times, the good moments, the situations where you were happy to be a San Francisco 49er fan and happy to be alive and life was good. And the 49ers were part of the reason life was good. So I think it's smart, and I think they're doing the right thing. And again, it seems to go hand in hand with some of the moves they made with the front office and the head coach, which I like, because it's creating a much better harmonious feeling. And let's give them a chance. Let's give them a shot now to go and do their thing. And then let's see what happens.
All right. Well, Carmen, let's toast to the 49ers of the past and all the great successes that you were a part of. And how is the winery doing these days?
Oh, I'll tell you, the wines are superb. They're drinking so well, and they're being critically acclaimed. And they're actually, believe it or not, it's even getting better, because the vineyard which we planted is coming into its sweet spot now, and it's really coming into its its best. So the present is great, and the future looks even better. Now, if I could figure out this element called business, where you're supposed to bring in more at the end of the year than goes out. If I could readjust that so that it at least balances, that would really make it fun to be in the wine business.
I have a feeling you give away a few bottles of wine too, and I know I've been on the receiving end of that at a certain luncheon every year for the past couple of years.
And we're going to continue that luncheon, I assure you. And by the way, I do a pretty good job myself of consuming inventory. So we enjoy the lifestyle up here in the Napa Valley. It's really great. It's beautiful, first of all, but it's a great lifestyle.
And where can people purchase your wine? And is the winery open for tours and for tasting?
Well, we're not open here, but we have a little tasting room at a Mending Wall Winery up in Calistoga. But you can go on www.casapiena.com, CASAPIENA.com. Now, that was shameless. I apologize. If my wife heard me do that, she'd be waving her finger at me saying, that's crass commercialism.
Well, I asked for it, so not so crass. Hey, Carmen, it's been an absolute pleasure to catch up with you, and very fun to talk about something that's going on in the Bay Area now, the Golden State Warriors, and making that link to a time, and it's not a far-fetched link at all, back to the 49ers of the 80s and 90s, and how you guys were able to remain at such a high level for such a long period of time.
Well, thank you for the opportunity, because I assure you it was fun for me to carry on this conversation.
The 49ers Insider Podcast on NBC Sports Bay Area.com.